Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The Red Cross describes the humanitarian situation in Yemen as unimaginable horror, saying two-thirds of the population is deprived of basic health care. The annual Hajj pilgrimage is nearing its end in the holy city of Mecca as Muslims around the world celebrate Eid al-Adha. Also, Kiev urges civilians in the southern Kherson region to urgently evacuate as Ukrainian forces are preparing a counterattack there. Hello and welcome. It's good to have you with us. The International Committee of the Red Cross highlights the worsening situation in Yemen, saying mothers and babies there are facing unimaginable horror. The humanitarian organization says two-thirds of the Yemeni population is deprived of basic health care. It urges the world community not to turn a blind eye to the plight of Yemenis, adding that the people there should not be left alone. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has resulted in a dire humanitarian situation. Riyadh's blockade has made the situation even worse as Yemenis are denied access to badly needed medicines, food, and other basic necessities. UN figures released at the end of 2021 indicated that nearly 380,000 Yemenis had died since the start of the war in 2015. More than two-thirds of them were children under the age of five. Saudi forces have opened fire in a border area of Yemen's Sa'da province in violation of a UN-brokered ceasefire. Yemeni media reports say 17 people have been killed or wounded in the cross-border fire. The wounded people were transferred to a hospital in the city of Razi. Elsewhere in Sa'da, Saudi forces also reportedly shelled Shada district, leaving one person dead and seven others injured. These come despite a truce agreed by warring parties in April that has been extended until August. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in 2015 with the aim of reinstalling a friendly regime. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed since then. Riyadh's military action has pushed Yemen into what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Nearly 40,000 Iranian pilgrims have embarked on the Hajj pilgrimage after a two-year interval due to the coronavirus pandemic. Many more have been waiting for years to visit the holy place. Our correspondent Mahdi Abbasian has a report from Mecca.
After 2 years of waiting for the Hajj, caravans of pilgrims and lovers of the sacred house of God have converged on Mecca. Nearly 40,000 Iranian pilgrims were also among the 850,000 foreign pilgrims who have visited Saudi Arabia for 2022 Hajj. Many of them have been waiting for years for their turn.
After 17 years of waiting, I was able to visit this holy place, and I hope all Iranians could one day travel to this sacred land.
I've traveled to Mecca after 15 years of waiting, and I hope all Muslims' wishes come true.
Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, most of them for over a decade. And this year, Saudi-imposed restrictions on the Hajj pilgrimage have dealt a blow to many Iranians' hopes. Ministry of Hajj and Umrah barred pilgrims under the age of 65 from participating in the Hajj. Also, pilgrims must be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 and have a negative coronavirus test before leaving for the kingdom. Those who have had the chance to be next to the Holy Kaaba, however, haven't forgotten others.
We are very happy to be on this spiritual journey and ask God to give all those who want to be here the chance to do so.
The only wish I can make in this holy place is well-being and redemption for all Muslims.
Right now, I'm standing in the middle of the holiest place on the planet for all Muslims, the Grand Mosque in Mecca, next to the Holy Kaaba. And I intend to perform Tawaf on behalf of all Muslims who have to wait at least for another year to get the chance to visit this sacred place.
Mahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
Ukraine's deputy prime minister has called on civilians in the Russia-controlled southern region of Kherson to urgently evacuate. Irina Vereshchuk issued the call as the Ukrainian armed forces are preparing a counterattack there. She said the people are asked to leave as the region could come under artillery shelling. She said the people should not turn into human shields. Kherson's authorities say they want to hold a referendum on joining the Russia Federation, but they have not yet set a date. The Kremlin says the future of the region should be determined by its residents. Ukraine lost control of most of the Black Sea region of Kherson, including its eponymous capital, in the first weeks after Russia launched a military offensive on February 24th this year. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern says there is no end in sight for the war in Ukraine, since the United States seems reluctant to end its involvement.
Now, the outlook is not very good, because if the President of the United States says we're going to be there for as long as it takes, well, it's a very long time it's going to take. Mr. Putin says, well, you're going to try to beat us in Ukraine. Give it a try. So bottom line here is that this will continue at least until the midterm elections in November, and who suffers from that? The Ukrainians. The citizens who live near these depots where these weapons are going in. That's the sorrowful part. This thing needs to stop. There is the possibility of a ceasefire. Russia, I think, will stop for a sensible negotiation, but we're in it for the long haul, says our intelligence people, and our president says, for as long as it takes. So look for more bloodshed, look for more Russian advances. The only question is, where will Russia stop as it goes west? Will it take Odessa? Will it go all the way to Moldova? That's a main question. And if negotiations don't start soon, that question will be answered by the Russian army.
Iran's president once again pledges continued support for the anti-Israeli resistance front, particularly Syria. Ebrahim Raisi says Iran is for peace and stability and against any foreign intervention in Syria. In a phone call with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Raisi congratulated the Syrian government and nation on the occasion of Eid al-Adha. The Iranian president hailed the recent visit to Tehran by President Assad and the good agreements that were reached between the two sides. Raisi called for efforts to follow through and implement the deals. Assad also noted that the enemies of the resistance front are growing weaker by the day. He said Iran and Syria are brothers in arms and wished the two nations increasing success at home and abroad. Iran says it has enriched uranium to a purity of 20% using a cascade of advanced centrifuges it launched 2 weeks ago. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says this was the final technical stage in the process. He said Iran had in advance informed the UN Nuclear Agency of its plan to inject uranium gas into a cluster of IR-6 centrifuges at the Fordow facility. According to Behruz Kamalvandi, the Western media started hyping up the issue as soon as the International Atomic Energy Agency verified Iran's enrichment. On Saturday, Reuters cited an IAEA report which confirms Iran has increased enrichment using advanced machines. The news agency once again highlighted Western concerns about Iran's nuclear program, despite acknowledging that Iran had indeed informed the agency of its enrichment plan. Tehran says the Western tactics are only meant to pressure it at the ongoing talks for the removal of sanctions. U.S. President Joe Biden defends his decision to visit Saudi Arabia and meet its crown prince despite criticism that he is abandoning his stated concerns about the kingdom's human rights record. Biden has written in an opinion piece for the Washington Post that his upcoming visit aims to strengthen a strategic partnership with Riyadh. Biden says the U.S. will use Saudi Arabia's vital energy resources to mitigate the impact of the war in Ukraine on global supplies. That's amid surging fuel costs and inflation at home. But the visit goes against Biden's repeated pledges to make Saudi Arabia pay for the killing and dismemberment of dissident journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. Biden's administration has released intelligence findings showing Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman masterminded Khashoggi's murder.
After spending his first year and a half in office mostly trying to avoid deeper engagement in West Asia while prioritizing challenges at home and in other parts of the world such as China and Russia, President Biden seems to be making a slight shift towards dedicating more time and attention to West Asia. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forward with the Abraham Accords, which is the main pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region. From its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran.
Well, Israel has been the problem in the Middle East since their inception. And even before that, when they were under British occupation, Palestine was under British occupation, the Zionists were the cause of the problems in the Middle East, going back to the bombing of the King David Hotel. So Israel has been a really terrible neighbor for all of the surrounding countries to them. You mentioned Syria. Yes, I was in Syria several times when Israel was being the aggressor and actively bombing the Syrian people who've done nothing to them. They occupy Syrian territory in the Golan Heights. Israel has been just a terrible neighbor to everyone. They've been abusive of the Palestinian people. I've been to the Palestinian, what they call camps, refugee camps, and these are 70 years old now. These are not new. These are established communities that they refer to as camps. They drove the people off their land. They stole their land that they have no right and no claim to. So yes, Israel is the nexus of the problem in the Middle East.
Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seems to not only integrate the regime further into the region, it also aims to advance its plan to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and the Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. Meanwhile, Iran has reiterated that normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel encourages and strengthens the regime to continue its crimes. President Ebrahim Raisi in April even compared friendship with Israel to keeping a snake in proximity.
The U.S. government has been under fire for supporting Israeli and Saudi leaders, and its weak response to human rights violations from crimes committed against the Palestinians to the case of Shirin Abu Akleh and Jamal Khashoggi. And now Joe Biden seems to be ignoring the crimes to compensate for his administration's wrong economic policies.
Americans have been feeling the economic pressure of inflation in recent months, with surging domestic gasoline prices adding to that burden. There are expectations that President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia will include a direct request from the kingdom to increase its oil production in the hopes of offsetting the rising costs for American consumers at the pump. During his campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah. But now, in a move seen by rights advocates as at odds with his promise to put human rights at the heart of U.S. foreign policy, Biden is set to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he struggles to combat record-high U.S. gasoline prices.
Biden has done some very foolish economic policies in the U.S. Initially, like day one after his inauguration, he cut off the Keystone Pipeline, and he turned the United States from an oil-exporting country into an oil-importing country. What Biden was not counting on was the rest of the world is sanctioning the U.S. and not wanting to deal in dollars, and they're not wanting to supply the U.S. with commodities and or finished goods. So Biden's economic policies have been an unmitigated failure. And so, yes, Biden is going to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis to increase oil production.
Meanwhile, the United States is facing accusations of whitewashing the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh after concluding the bullet that killed her likely came from Israeli military gunfire, but stopping short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing. Abu Akleh was wearing a press uniform while reporting on an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank when she was fatally shot in the head on May 11th. Since the killing, several media and human rights organizations have all determined that the Israeli military killed Abu Akleh. All this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
The South Korean military claims that North Korea has fired what appear to be multiple rocket launchers. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the military detected flight trajectories possibly shot from North Korean artillery. It didn't give further details, but said the military is closely monitoring the situation. Tensions run high on the Korean peninsula as Pyongyang has carried out a series of missile tests this year. Recently, newly elected South Korean president warned against any provocative behavior by the North. Yoon Suk-yeol also talked about boosting military capabilities in close cooperation with the United States. Pyongyang, however, says its nuclear and missile programs are for self-defense in the face of U.S.-led threats. North Korea has also repeatedly denounced joint military drills between the U.S. and South Korea as invasion rehearsals. In Japan, polling stations for parliamentary elections have closed, while the whole process was overshadowed by the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Abe's ruling Liberal Democratic Party already enjoys a solid majority of seats. Initial reports show the party is gaining sympathy votes. There has been a surge of support for the Liberal Democrats in the wake of Abe's assassination. The popular former prime minister was assassinated during a campaign speech in support of a local candidate on July the 8th. The suspect, now in custody, has told investigators he targeted Abe because he believed the politician was linked to an unnamed organization. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Thanks for your company.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, former Chancellor Rishi Sunak has thrown his hat into the ring in the race to succeed Boris Johnson. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Heather Stewart, Rainer Mason and Peter Walker. The piece is titled Rishi Sunak to Stand for Conservative Party Leader. Former Chancellor Rishi Sunak described himself as a serious candidate for serious times as he kick-started his campaign to become the UK's next Prime Minister, with as many as 15 Conservative MPs expected to run for the party's leadership. The former Chancellor launched his bid on Friday, 8th of July, after telling colleagues he had 80 to 100 MPs behind him. Some began declaring their support publicly, including Mark Harper, the former Chief Whip, Oliver Dowden, the former party co-chair, and Mark Spencer, the leader of the House of Commons. Rishi Sunak's announcement came in a slickly edited 3-minute video message posted on Twitter under the slogan, Ready for Rishi. I'm standing to be the next leader of the Conservative Party and your Prime Minister, he said. Let's restore trust, rebuild the economy, and reunite the country. His declaration capped an extraordinary week in Westminster in which Boris Johnson's authority dramatically collapsed, with more than 50 members of his government quitting before the Prime Minister finally announced his resignation on Thursday, 7th of July. Saying the country faced serious challenges, Rishi Sunak strongly indicated he would resist calls for widespread tax cuts or a spending spree. Do we confront this moment with honesty, seriousness and determination, or do we tell ourselves comforting fairy tales that might make us feel better in the moment, but will make our children worse off tomorrow, he said. Tax cuts are expected to feature heavily in what is likely to be a chaotic and at times bitter leadership race. Another declared candidate, the One Nation Tory, Tom Tugendhat, has already called for the recent national insurance increase to be reversed. The former Equalities Minister, Kemi Badenoch, announced her candidacy in The Times, also appeared to back lower taxes, saying she wanted a limited government focused on the essentials. His announcement came as allies of Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, said she was seriously considering running for the leadership of the Conservative Party, suggesting the politics of some of the other frontrunners were unclear. "You don't need to think about Priti. You know where she stands," one said, comparing her to Margaret Thatcher. The Culture Secretary, Nadine Dorries, a diehard Boris Johnson loyalist, is also reportedly consulting colleagues about whether she has sufficient support to run. The Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, considered a potential frontrunner, could also declare his bid. Arch-Brexiter Steve Baker has announced that he would not run but would support a bid by the Attorney General, Suella Braverman, on Friday evening. He tweeted, "I considered standing for the leadership. My priorities were delivering against our manifesto with our mandate, cutting taxes and seeing through Brexit. Happily, I no longer need to stand. Suella Braverman will deliver these priorities and more." Boris Johnson fired the starting gun on the race on Thursday, 7th of July, when he reluctantly quit as Conservative leader with a defiant speech describing his colleague's decision to oust him as eccentric and a result of herd instinct. One senior Tory with knowledge of Boris Johnson's mood described him as confused on Friday. "Not focused in a dumb sense, he fully understands the process, but he is confused as to their plan and strategy, because there isn't a clear way through." Johnson continued to fill the post in his caretaker government with loyalist Peter Bone, made deputy leader of the House of Commons, and his policy chief Andrew Griffith, a junior trade minister. Other cabinet ministers are expected to declare their candidacy in the coming days, including the new chancellor, Nadeem Zahawi, the foreign secretary, Liz Truss, the health secretaries turned backbenchers, Sajid Javid and Jeremy Hunt. Nadeem Zahawi is believed to have the most organised campaign, with a team in place advised by Linton Crosby's former business partner Mark Fulbrook. The executive of the Backbench 1922 committee will be re-elected next Monday and is then expected to set out the rules and duration of the leadership race, including spending limits. While some MPs have been pressing for Boris Johnson to step down as soon as possible, others are keen to see a full-blown contest, perhaps lasting until September, to allow for the backgrounds of the candidates to be properly scrutinised. Boris Johnson's premiership unravelled after it emerged that he appointed Chris Pincher as deputy chief whip, despite knowing of his past alleged sexual misconduct. "I think all of the candidates have got significant due diligence vulnerabilities. things they're exposed on that will hit the media, said one senior Conservative MP, adding, there's really going to be a big field. I think there could be as many as 15 candidates or even more. A former cabinet minister said the worst possible thing that could happen to the Tory party is that they appoint somebody in a hurry, and that person has another ethical problem, whether it's a money problem, a historic drugs problem, or other problems. If that happens, however good the policies are, we're in trouble at the next election. Party insiders are warning that the race, in which the field will be narrowed down to two MPs, ideally by the time Parliament rises on 21st of July, before Tory members get the final vote, is expected to be hard-fought. I think it will be a very divisive contest, knowing the sort of people who are involved. I think there will be a lot of really nasty briefing, said one senior Tory. Speculation at Westminster has also already turned to whether a new leader would feel obliged to call a snap election, perhaps within 6 months, to give them a personal mandate. If they want to do anything big and new, it's a 75 majority under old manifesto and a Boris Johnson platform, which is dead, said a party insider. If you actually want to do stuff, radical things in a recession, then you have to put it to the country. The leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, has made clear he will push for a general election. At a press conference after the news that he would not be fined for an alleged breach of lockdown rules, Keir Starmer said, if there's a general election, this government will fall and we've got a plan for the country. As a leadership race unfolds, there are likely to be perils and controversies ahead for Boris Johnson's caretaker role at No. 10 Downing Street. While it has been agreed he will not introduce new policies or major fiscal decisions, Johnson's spokesperson stressed that potentially contentious actions on existing plans, such as defending court cases to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda and pushing through the bill to unilaterally amend the Northern Ireland Protocol, would go ahead. Among other tricky moves looming is a decision on a series of public sector pay awards amid the threat of strikes. The government's verdict on these could come as early as next week, potentially with several awards announced simultaneously.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Viewpoints. You're listening to analysis on the most important events taking place in the Islamic calendar. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Sayyid Alavi. Sayyid Alavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to
you. Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My salams to you and the dear audience. Thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much.
So, as Al-Hajj 18th, let's get back to, we can say, to the history and back time, the year 10th of Hijrah, of course, after Hijrah. A very right. important event took place, and that is Prophet Muhammad is on his way back from Hajjat al-Wada.
Yeah.
So in the middle of the way, in a place called Qadir Khum, you know, he stops all the companions, all the travelers, you know, waits for the others to join him to give a very important news. What's that news, Sayyid Alavi?
Well, maybe the news were about who would be the successor of the Prophet.
Okay.
You know, you have the Sunnah of the Prophet, and we being from the Ahl Sunnah,
yes,
following the Sunnah of the Prophet, we, according to historical narrations, the Prophet never left any city without a successor.
Mm-hmm.
And he never left an area without a wali or a successor.
Okay.
In every region in the Arabian Peninsula, he would leave a successor of his,
that's right,
even when he left Medina as a clear example. Now, Ghadir al-Khum, you know, there was a verse, yes, prior to the event of Ghadir between Mecca and Medina, where the verse says that, O Prophet, reveal or balligh, convey. Yes, exactly. Convey what has been revealed upon you. Because if you do not, then you have not conveyed our message.
Okay.
The question is, the fundamental question is, what message? I mean, is the Prophet about to speak about Hajj? Is the Prophet about to speak about the prayers, about the zakah, about fasting? Okay. No, he has already talked about this,
yes,
and the regulations, okay, and the ahkam. So everyone knew about it.
So,
then
so
what
sorry,
is
the
it?
Ayah was revealed on the spot?
It was prior
or
to...
Prior to
Ghadir, and that's why, okay, the Prophet stopped.
Uh-huh.
And if you do not, it is like you have not conveyed our message during 23 years.
Yes,
It is nothing. And do not be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
The verse continues.
Yes.
Do not be afraid of whom? There was a fright in the heart of the Prophet. He was afraid of some people and how they would conceive the message.
Okay.
So do not be afraid. We will be your guardian. We will help you.
That's right.
And then the Prophet comes with the example that you said,
yes,
that he stopped all the companions. He told the companions who were traveling to come back during a severe heat.
Yes.
And he had a speech for around 1 hour. And the culmination...
Just lifting up the kajavas,
you know,
the carriages of the camels on the top of the
mountain-like
thing, to see the, all the people see.
Exactly,
okay?
Exactly.
Taking the hand of Amir al-Mu'minin and introducing him as Wali. Now, Sheikh, this is the main question, the word Wali, okay?
I'm sorry, interrupting you. Can I just finish one more quote? There was a verse prior to Ghadir, and there was a verse after the Ghadir.
Ayatul Tabligh and Ayatul Ikmal.
Exactly. That is very important.
Yeah.
The event happened
between these two ayats. Okay.
Now you have conveyed our message. Now the deen that is recognized in Allah is Islam and so on. Now you have completed your religion.
So first is Ayatul Tabligh of what's going to happen.
Yes.
Then the event of Ghadir al-Khum.
And it took 3 days.
Yeah.
3 days of bay'ah, paying allegiance to the imam, the new successor after the Prophet.
So how was the bay'ah? The people coming or shaking hands?
The people came
and
put their hands in their hands. The custom of the Arabs today is still the same. Yes, all the companions who were there.
That's right.
Had that custom. They paid allegiance and it took 3 days. These are subtle points that we need to recognize.
Okay, Sheikh, why not referring to such an important incident directly in the text of the Holy Quran? I mean, for example, introducing Ali as the successor or bringing the term Wali in the Quran to exactly refer to what's happening, because it's a very important incident, isn't it, in the Islamic history?
Yeah, of course. First of all, let me mention this example. We have a hadith in which it is mentioned that Ana Madinatul Ilm wa Aliyun Babuha.
That's right. Okay.
So you see, some of these scholars who were opposed to Amir al-Mu'minin, they interpret this Ali as Rafi'a.
A person with higher status.
Yeah, that's it. Or Rafi'un Babuha. It means that the door or the entrance door of that city is in a very high position.
Okay.
It doesn't mean Ali ibn Abi Talib, Ali son of Abu Talib.
Oh.
So, you know, if sometimes you do not want to accept something, even if it is explicitly mentioned in the Ayatul Quran, then you can deny that.
That's right.
As many hypocrites denied many things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in one of the Hajj, the Prophet ﷺ told the companions to shave their heads.
Okay.
And some of them denied and rejected the direct order of the Prophet. Said that, why don't you do that? Don't you do that? The same thing. He said, it's not my first Hajj. It's your first Hajj. You have to do this.
Okay.
So I want to say that the opposition to Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi wasalam was very much clear at that time to the Holy Prophet and to the companions of the Holy Prophet. But certain qualities mentioned in the Holy Quran about the successor, about the imam, about the leader of Muslims.
Okay.
If you just refer to these qualities, you would absolutely understand that the only instance for these ayat is only Ali ibn Abi Talib. Because sometimes It is directly referred to some of the actions and deeds that the Imam Ali alayhi salam performed in his life.
Okay.
So that's why it was so much clear for all the people that Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam was the, let's say, the successor of the Prophet. Not only in Ghadir and many other, let's say, occasions.
In many other occasions, for example, you, Ali, to me are like Aaron to Moses or other hadith, referring directly to the character of Imam Ali. But it's still the same question is over here. Why not referring to such an important incident, directly in the text of the Holy Quran? For example, in an ayah or something like that, and explaining the word Wali. Because here the problem from our Ahlus Sunnah is on the term Wali. How to define it, okay? And when they oppose such an incident or something like that, Imam Ali alayhi salam was called as a friend of Prophet Muhammad or something like that, and does not mean a successor or the first, we can't say successor of Prophet Muhammad.
You know, whatever the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam say, it is not something, it is impossible to be something opposed to the Holy Quran. Rather, it is directly compatible to what is mentioned in the Holy Quran.
Okay.
So when the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam introduces Amir al-Mu'minin in many occasions in his life, from the beginning of Islam till the end of his life, so in many occasions, it is an order that he received from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So it's it's obeying the commandment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we should not separate what the Prophet says, what the Prophet, for example, explained about these kind of important events from the Quran.
That's right.
You know, in the Holy Quran, for example, it's mentioned that you have to say prayers. So how should we do that? Then if the Prophet say that, okay, you have to pray this way, it is exactly compatible to the Holy Quran. It is exactly in accordance with the Holy Quran. There's no difference between the tradition, the Sunnah of the Prophet and the Quran. So in the Holy Quran, it's mentioned that this is Wali.
Yes.
Wali is this. So then the Prophet explained it. It is the same as the Salah. Yes. Salah is mentioned in the Holy Quran, but the way we perform Salah is explained by the Prophet. So when Wali is mentioned in the Quran, then we should refer to the Prophet. Who is Wali?
Right.
If Prophet explains it and interprets these ayat for us, so then we would understand that it is the order, it's the commandment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that's obeyed by the Prophet in Ghadir al-Khum in other events.
That's all right.
Even but, if it's not mentioned in the Noble Quran explicitly, although we have verses which say that your Wali is God, the Prophet, and those who pray when they are in ruku', and the Mufassirin of all denominations say that it is one.
Those who bow in ruku' and give, for example, their ring they pay,
they give sadaqah.
And
all the interpreters of all denominations say that it is one person here that is the verse is referring to. But then you have, as Sheikh said, the life and the sunnah of the Prophet, which completes the Noble Quran. And then you asked about why do some people come with the interpretation of friend, Wali being a friend.
Yes.
So we ask,
because one of the important meanings of Wali is friend.
Let us assume that the Wali means friend, okay? No
or
problem.
Or best friend, okay.
What do you do with the rest of khutbah of Ghadir al-Khum, where the Prophet mentions the other points of successes? What do you do with that part? So you just take that part of the khutbah and then you leave the rest.
Okay.
And then you have very strong, logical reasons for not interpreting it as a friend, because they said there was a argument between him and a person by the name of Khalid ibn al-Walid when they came back from Yemen. All right, so why should the Prophet stop all of these companions during heat, severe heat, tell the people who traveled to come back to Ghadir and then have a 3 days bay'ah? We need to wake up here, spiritual awakening.
Okay.
Spiritual awakening. We need to wake up. And
was it done all on purpose? For example, to make a speaking terms between the person you mentioned and Imam Ali, because they were on a dispute, okay?
It doesn't hold. That's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't hold to say that,
it's
look,
not a
people,
good excuse to stop
exactly,
all the people.
Exactly. People stop here. He is my friend. So whomever I am the friend of, you should take Ali as his friend.
Yes.
No. The thing here, the incident here, is much more fundamental much more deeper than that. 3 days during severe heat.
Okay.
If you had an argument with a couple of people, you take Imam Ali into a tent and you take those people into that tent and you talk about that thing, and it's over with. But then you have all of this spectacle.
Of course,
going
the tents
on.
Were uprised later.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Under those tents, some conspiracies took place. Okay.
Sorry, I wanted to add one more point to the points mentioned by a brother.
Sure.
This is that. Let's assume that Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam mentioned the term, for example, wali. Mm-hmm. Suppose that he meant friend. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if all the companions of the prophets had to be the good friends of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, so do we annoy a friend or we obey and follow a friend?
Okay.
This is the point.
That's right.
So it is explicit. It's very much clear that Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was opposed to the caliphate of the first caliph.
Okay.
It's clear. Mm-hmm. Lady Zahra Salamullah alayha was opposed to this khilafah. And she did not pay allegiance to Khalifa till the end of her life. So this is clear. And Amir al-Mu'min Ali alayhi wasalam was forcefully paid allegiance to Abu Bakr, to the first Khalifa.
Yes.
They forced him. So it's clear that there's no doubt about them. So if...
But there was no opposition during
If he disagreed the Khilafah, so you were the friends of Amir al-Mu'min.
Yes.
So why didn't you follow him?
Yeah, there were so many arguments, so many reasons. Sheikh mentioned two, three. There were so many more.
Yes.
When you put that history side by side, you come to a conclusion.
Yes.
Who was the wali and the imam and the khalifa of Fatima to Zahra salamullah alayha? And what do you do with this verse? This day I have perfected your religion for you, completed my favor upon you, and have chosen for you Islam as your religion. But as for him who is forced by severe hunger, and then he continues, what has that to do with being a friend?
Yes.
Oh, people become the friends of Ali? Why? What has that to do with becoming a friend?
That's right.
It is much deeper than that. So we need to wake up, leave all our prejudices, and then you have tons of other arguments during the three khulafa.
That's right. It was very nice of you, Sayyid Alawi and Sheikh
Thank you
for your presence in the program. Viewpoints talking about Qadir al-Khum events, and I would like again to express my congratulations on this happy aid to all the Muslims around the world. Whether Ali ibn Abi Talib is your imam or not, he is the source of light and benefit for all the Muslims. Believe me, brothers and sisters, and Muslims all across the world. Thank you very much for listening to us, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information on this program and to download for free our other episodes, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN/Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
America and the world would be far safer places if this outrageous spending was drastically cut and those funds redirected to moral investments in people, society, and planetary health, not war and weapons, says William Hartung, author, in an article published under the heading America's $1.4 trillion so-called national security budget makes us less safe, not more. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. This March, when the Biden administration presented a staggering $813 billion proposal for national defense, it was hard to imagine a budget that could go significantly higher or be more generous to the denizens of the military-industrial complex. After all, that request represented far more than peak spending in the Korean or Vietnam War years, and well over $100 billion more than at the height of the Cold War. It was, in fact, an astonishing figure by any measure, more than 2.5 times what China spends. More, in fact, than, and hold your hats, for this one, the national security budgets of the next 9 countries, including China and Russia combined. And yet the weapons industry and hawks in Congress are now demanding that even more be spent. In recent National Defense Authorization Act proposals, which always set a marker for what Congress is willing to fork over to the Pentagon, the Senate and the House Armed Services Committees both voted to increase the 2023 budget yet again by $45 billion in the case of the Senate and $37 billion for the House. The final figure won't be determined until later this year, but Congress is likely to add tens of billions of dollars more than even the Biden administration wanted to what will most likely be a record for the Pentagon's already bloated budget. This lust for yet more weapons spending is especially misguided at a time when a never-ending pandemic, growing heat waves, and other depredations of climate change and racial and economic injustice are devastating the lives of millions of Americans. Make no mistake about it. The greatest risk to Americans' safety and their future are non-military in nature. With the exception, of course, of the threat of nuclear war, which could increase if the current budget goes through as planned. But as Tom Dispatch readers know, the Pentagon is just one element in an ever more costly American national security state. Adding their military, intelligence, and internal security expenditures to the Pentagon's budget brings the total upcoming national security budget to a mind-boggling $1.4 trillion. And note that in June 2021, the last time the Mandy Smithberger and other authors add up Such cost to the taxpayer debt figure was almost $1.3 trillion, so the trend is obvious. To understand how these vast sums are spent year after year, let's take a quick tour of America's national security budget, top to bottom. The Pentagon's proposed base budget, which includes all of its routine expenses from personnel to weapons to the cost of operating and maintaining a 1.3 million member military force, came in at $773 billion for 2023, more than $30 billion above that 2022. Such an increase alone is three times the discretionary budget of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and more than three times the total allocation for the Environmental Protection Agency. In all, the Pentagon consumes nearly half of the discretionary budget of the whole federal government, a figure that's come down slightly in recent years thanks to the Biden administration's increased investment in civilian activities. That still means, however, that almost anything the government wants to do other than preparing for or waging war involves a scramble for funding, while the Department of Defense, better to say, the Department of War, gets virtually unlimited financial support. And keep in mind that the proposed Biden increase in Pentagon spending comes despite the ending of 20 years of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan, a move that should have meant significant reductions in the department's budget. Perhaps you won't be surprised to learn, however, that in the wake of the Afghan disaster, the military establishment and hawks in Congress quickly shifted gears to touting and exaggerating challenges posed and inflation as reasons for absorbing the potential savings from the Afghan war and pressing the Pentagon budget ever higher. It's worth looking at what America stands to receive for its $773 billion, or about $2,000 per taxpayer, according to an analysis by the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. More than half of that amount goes to giant weapons contractors like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, along with thousands of smaller arms-making firms. The most concerning part of the new budget proposal, however, may be the administration's support for a three-decades-long $1.7 trillion plan to build a new generation of nuclear-armed missiles, as well, of course, as new warheads to go with them, bombers and submarines. As the organization Global Zero has pointed out, the United States could dissuade any country from launching an atomic attack against it with far fewer weapons than are contained in its current nuclear arsenal. There is simply no need for a costly and risky nuclear weapons modernization plan. Sadly, it's guaranteed to help fuel a continuing global nuclear arms race. While entrenching nuclear weapons as a mainstay of national security policy for decades to come, wouldn't those decades be so much better spent working to eliminate nuclear weapons together? The riskiest weapon in that nuclear plan is a new land-based intercontinental ballistic missile ICBM. As former Secretary of Defense William Perry once explained, ICBMs are among the most dangerous weapons in the world because a president warned of a nuclear attack would have only a matter of minutes to decide whether to launch them, increasing the risk of an accidental nuclear war based on a false alarm. Not only is a new ICBM unnecessary, but the existing ones should be retired as well as a way of reducing the potential for a world-ending nuclear conflagration. To its credit, Biden administration is trying to get rid of an ill-conceived nuclear weapons program initiated during the Trump years, a sea-launched nuclear-armed cruise missile that, rather than adding a deterrent capability, would raise the risk of a nuclear confrontation. As expected, nuclear hawks in the military and Congress are trying to restore funding for that nuclear SLCM, pronounced SLCM. The Pentagon budget is replete with other unnecessary, overpriced, and often potentially dysfunctional systems that should either be canceled or replaced with more affordable and effective alternatives. The most obvious case in point is the F-35 combat aircraft meant to carry out multiple missions for the Air Force, Navy, and Marines. So far, it does not do them. In a series of careful analyses of the aircraft, the project on government oversight determined that it may never be fully ready for combat. As for the cost, at an estimated $1.7 trillion over its projected period of service, it's already the most expensive single weapons program ever undertaken by the Pentagon. And keep in mind that those costs will only increase as the military services are forced to pay to fix problems that were never addressed in the rush to deploy the plane before it was fully tested. Meanwhile, that aircraft is so complex that at any given moment, a large percentage of the fleet is down for maintenance, meaning that if ever called on for combat duty, many of those planes will simply not be available. In a grudging acknowledgement of the multiple problems plaguing the F-35, the Biden administration proposed decreasing its buy of the plane by about a third in 2023, a figure that should have been much lower given its poor performance. But congressional advocates of the plane, including a large F-35 caucus made up of members in states or districts where parts of it are being produced, will undoubtedly continue to press for more planes than even the Pentagon's asking for, as the Senate Armed Services Committee did its markup of the Department of Defense spending bill. In addition to all of this, the Pentagon's base budget includes mandatory spending for items like military retirement, totaling an estimated $12.8 billion for 2023. Running national insecurity tally is $785.8 billion.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.